Greetings and welcome to the Science Podcast for May 13th, 2011. I'm Stuart Wills. This week, designing protein interactions from scratch, new hopes in the search for an AIDS cure, and comparing the efficiency of photosynthesis and photovoltaic cells. All this plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
A paper in Science this week describes a new method for designing from scratch, and on a computer, proteins that bind with high affinity to specific patches on other proteins, in much the way that an antibody binds to its target. Using the method, the team was able to design two proteins that bound to a specific molecular surface on the 1918 pandemic influenza virus. It's not a cure for the flu, but the paper's senior author, David Baker, suggests that the technique, once perfected, could prove useful in drug development. It's also potentially useful as a way to gain a deeper understanding of protein-protein interactions, which are crucial to a wide range of biological processes. Baker spoke with me about the work from his office at the University of Washington.
Protein-protein interactions are really critical throughout biology. They're basically how all the individual parts in our bodies interact with each other. People have been studying protein interactions for a long time, and a critical test of understanding is being able to make new ones. So we want to know whether we understood enough about protein-protein interactions to design brand new interactions from scratch. And this has been the goal of the basic research we've been doing in my group for some time in this area. If one could design protein-protein interactions from scratch, there'd be many interesting and perhaps useful applications. One possible one is described in this paper.
Mel, when you say designing proteins from scratch, or protein-protein interactions from scratch, you're talking about designing them on a computer, and I'm guessing there isn't an app for that. How do you actually set something like that up?
Well, that's the hard part, right? You have to develop a computer algorithm which knows enough about the physics of protein-protein interactions to be able to create new ones from scratch. And so in the computer program, one encodes everything one knows or thinks one knows about what's important in protein-protein interactions. And then when you actually go and make designed proteins, designed interactions, the ideas you put into your algorithm are validated or refuted by the success or failure of your designs.
And presumably that requires a great deal of computing power as well.
Yeah, it does take a lot of computing power. We're very fortunate to have volunteer computing from Rosetta at Home volunteers who have been helping us with all aspects of our research.
Okay, well, let's take a closer look at the actual work you did. You chose to look at a specific region on a protein from the 1918 pandemic influenza virus. Why that virus and why the specific protein and region that you looked at?
Well, if you were going to design a protein to bind to a target, you might pick a target that where if you could make a binder, it would be useful. And obviously, the influenza virus, especially that the H1N1, is a target that one could imagine in a new flu outbreak would be very important to be able to bind and to block. We chose that epitope because there had been a structure determined in fairly recently which showed that if you bound to that epitope, you could block the virus. So we thought it was a good candidate for this approach.
So you selected that virus and that epitope. What did you do then? Tell me a little bit about the work.
What our computer method does is, well, its goal is to be able to design a very tight binder to any surface patch on any protein. So basically, we pointed the algorithm at this particular surface patch on the influenza hemagglutinin. And the first step in the procedure is to look for handholds and footholds, basically ways in which amino acid side chains can interact very strongly with that surface. At this stage, they're freely floating. They're disembodied. So you might find that one type of amino acid can fit into a nice groove on one side of the surface patch that you're trying to target. Another type of amino acid fits in somewhere else. Then in the second stage is like connecting the dots. We have to find scaffolding that will hold all of those interactions we've identified in the first step in the right places.
So you, in some sense, sort of start with the strongest interactions, match those up, and then sort of iterate to refine the fit?
That's right. That's right. So we start by, literally, it's like having disembodied hands and feet, just trying to figure out how you could really hold on to that surface tightly. And then we try and place the body so that the hands and feet are connected.
So what did this computation actually produce in the end?
It produced designed proteins for about 80 different candidate designs, each of which has a different amino acid sequence, and each one is predicted to bind the surface of the virus. So the next thing we did, of course, is we had to experimentally test them. And the computer, our computational methods, which use the Rosetta program we've developed, are quite far from perfect. So we actually ended up testing about 80 different designs and only found two that bound significantly to the virus.
And how does that sort of test work, actually?
Well, the way we do it is it takes advantages of real advances in synthetic biology. For each of these 80 designed proteins, they don't exist anywhere in nature. They're completely new. What we do is essentially fill out an order form to a gene synthesis company that makes genes, and we send it the sequences of these 80 proteins, and they send us back genes. And then we take these genes and we put them into yeast cells in such a way that the proteins, these designed proteins, appear on the outer surface of the yeast cell. And then to test whether they bind, we add fluorescently labeled target protein and see whether the cells become fluorescent.
So in the course of this process, you ended up with computationally derived proteins, and you tested those and found the ones that really bound tightly to this area of the influenza virus. So you have this method. What's the sort of larger significance? What sort of applications might you envision of a technique like this?
Well, there are many possible applications. One is for new drugs. We don't know yet whether these small proteins that we've designed will actually block the infectivity of the virus, but all the indications we have so far from the biochemical experiments suggest that they will. And you could imagine generating many more such designed proteins that target different flu strains. You could imagine designing proteins, and we're doing this, to other pathogens like Ebola virus, or pretty much any pathogen, whether it's a virus or a bacterium, has to get into cells somehow. And those interactions are almost always mediated by proteins. So if you could design small proteins to bind to those, you might have sort of a general approach to blocking pathogen entry. Also for diagnostics, if you wanted to detect something, you could design a protein that binds tightly to it. Another use is in molecular cell biology. Protein-protein interactions, as I described, play roles in almost all cellular processes. And it's very hard to disrupt them specifically, but if there was a particular process you were interested in and you had a design protein which bound tightly to one of the partners to disrupt that interaction, then you could use these small design proteins as tools to understand those interactions and their importance.
I gather, though, that in some sense we have a proof of concept here. There's still a lot to be done.
Yes, there's a huge amount to be done. I can emphasize that in two ways. First of all, we had to try 80 different designs to get two that worked, and that obviously is far from desirable. We'd like to have methods which are much better, which allow us to make it possible to design high-affinity binders in essentially every try. Another thing is that the initial binders, even those two, do not bind very tightly to the virus, so we had to use experimental methods to optimize them to become really high-affinity binders. So there's a lot of room for improvement in the computational methods, and we're working hard on that now. One thing we're going to be trying is the power of protein design game players. We've developed an online video game called Fold It, in which the general public can try to solve hard science problems, and we're going to be posting on Fold It these influenza binding designs and trying to see if people, challenging people to improve them, and we're then going to test them in the lab. So we're very excited to get sort of the general public, people outside of our group, working on design problems.
Well, that sounds pretty cool. Where would I go to actually do that?
Well, you would just look for Fold It on the web. You'd Google Fold It, and it gives you instructions on how to sign up. And then you would see a certain selection of puzzles there now. And in not too long, you'll start seeing flu virus design puzzles.
Oh, David Baker, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
David Baker is the senior author of a new paper on designing protein-protein interactions from scratch via computer. You can read the paper, as well as a related perspective article, in this week's Science. Since the advent of antiretroviral therapies, most AIDS treatment efforts have focused on managing and minimizing infection by the HIV virus, rather than the apparently more quixotic goal of actually finding a cure. But recent events, particularly the experience of one remarkable patient, have breathed new life into the notion of an AIDS cure, and have set researchers on a race to explore new strategies toward that end. Science contributing correspondent John Cohen writes about this new race to cure HIV infections in a News Focus article in this week's Science. He spoke with me about the story from his office in San Diego.
I think a lot of people assume that AIDS researchers have been working on a cure since the very beginning of the epidemic. And the truth is, it's just been far too complicated a challenge. And it's only been in the past 2 years that it's really become a serious research pursuit by many groups. And that's what the story is about, and it's also the story of one person who, in all likelihood, has actually been cured.
Well, before we get to that, what is it about HIV that has made it so resistant to a cure?
HIV, when it infects a human cell, it weaves itself into our own chromosomes. And that means it actually, as long as it lies dormant, it actually looks human. You can't even see it. The immune system has no indication that a cell is infected. That's been the biggest hurdle, is that the virus isn't even visible to the mechanisms that our body have to clear viruses.
Well, granted, it's very difficult to cure, but there are therapies for AIDS already, these so-called antiretroviral drugs that have been successful in at least keeping the disease in check. Why this push now, given that those drugs have been successful, to actually go beyond that and look for a cure?
One of the things that's become apparent over the past few years is people who are on long-term treatment with these antiretroviral drugs, even if they have very low levels of the virus, they still are dying young of different diseases. That basically, the low level of virus causes inflammation probably that leads to aging processes, things like cancer and heart disease. So the virus isn't good for you, even at low levels. The drugs themselves are toxic and expensive, and there's been a push to get the drugs to all of the poor people in the world who need them. And there are an estimated 15 million people who need them, and the world has only been able to provide access to 5 million of those people. So we're kind of backed up against the wall with the current drugs, as good as they are.
And I guess if I'm reading your story correctly, you know, as you mentioned, a lot of the new optimism that a cure might be achievable seems to stem from the experience of this one man, the so-called Berlin patient. Could you talk just a bit about that?
Yeah, that's definitely thrown a lot of fuel on the fire and given people hope, because it's a proof of concept. It's not that people anticipate replicating what happened with him. He's a very unusual case. He had a leukemia that threatened his life, and he had to have a bone marrow transplant. And his doctor knew about this unusual feature in a small percentage of people who have immune cells that are highly resistant to HIV, and he suggested finding a donor who had that genetic composition to basically replace this guy's immune system.
And what happened?
Well, he first had to have his body conditioned to accept the transplant, and that was very severe. Chemotherapy, whole body irradiation, it's called ablation. They actually kill off his own immune system. He almost died from that. And they transferred the donor's stem cells, and his leukemia returned, and he had to have it done a second time. But he stopped taking his HIV drugs, the antiretrovirals, from the first transplant, and the virus never returned. He hasn't taken drugs since for his HIV, and it's been 4.5 years, and nobody in any lab can find any HIV in any part of his body using the most sensitive tests available. So there's a growing consensus that he has actually been cured of HIV infection.
Well, that is a remarkable case, but it seems kind of like an outlier. I mean, in the sense that that kind of treatment path isn't really open to everyone.
That's right, it's not. But you have to think about this in the broader perspective of 60 million or more people have been infected with this virus. No one on Earth, other than this one man, has been cured in a clearly documented case. So it provides proof that the idea is possible. And there's an old saying in science that if you have a talking dog, you don't need a control group. You know, this is kind of a talking dog. It's so remarkable that you can do something that many people thought was completely impossible. Well, it is possible. You don't want to go down the route that this man went through. but there probably are clues based on his case to help people understand how to better engineer something that's more widely applicable.
So given that experience, the experience of this patient, it's raised people's optimism on the cure front, and at the same time that his particular cure is not, you know, for lack of a better word, scalable, what are some of the other avenues that scientists are exploring, you know, to follow up on this?
Well, what happened with this man, whose name is Timothy Brown, he's gone public and he spoke with me at some length over many, many months, is that idea of what led to his cure, there is a way to modify that to make that very same idea more widely available, where you take a person's own cells out of their body and modify those cells so that they're resistant and put them back in. So one avenue is to try gene therapy studies that do just that. Will that be widely applicable? Who knows? Will it work? Who knows? And it's obviously an expensive way to do things. So there is the possibility of doing that. Something else that Timothy Brown's case has brought to the fore is the notion that a cure need not remove all the virus from a person's body. When his case was first reported, many people scoffed at it, but the supporters of it said, hey, wait, who cares whether there's virus in his body? He's not taking any antiretroviral drugs, and the virus hasn't returned. And every other person who had gone off antiretroviral drugs, who had had a high level of virus in their body before the drugs, the virus came screaming back in a few weeks or months. So this created the notion of what's called now a functional cure, which means you can live with the virus, but you've reduced it to such a level that your own immune system can handle it. So several of the new approaches are aiming for a functional cure. They're saying, okay, it's okay if you have some virus left, but maybe there's a way for us to reduce the amount of virus in people to the point that it no longer requires treatment with these expensive and toxic drugs.
Well, there was also an interesting thread in your article in a different direction about, you know, the fact that there are these latent viruses that are sort of hidden from how we might attack them. This sort of notion of in some sense, trying to wake those those viruses
right
up, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, I think one of the important things that has happened over the past 15 years is, you know, 15 years ago, there were no good anti-HIV drugs. Then along came these cocktails that led to these Lazarus-like rebounds in people's health and completely changed the course of the epidemic. What those drugs did and what they've done in the past 15 years is they've revealed that once you clean up most of the virus in a person, there still remains these pools of cells that have latent virus that aren't popping out, so they're not being detected by the immune system. And that becomes the challenge. How do you flush out those reservoirs of latent virus? So many of the new strategies are called purge strategies or purge drugs because they're looking for ways to wake up those latent cells, make them produce the virus, and when they do that, when those cells produce the virus, they will be killed by the immune system or by basically self-destruction when they produce virus. The virus they produce can be mopped up by antiretroviral drugs, and over a period of time, researchers hope, you'll eventually deplete the reservoirs to the vanishing point, or so low that they no longer pose a threat.
Well, it sounds like there's a lot that's really exciting going on. Is there any way to put even a vague number on how long it might be before one or more of these efforts actually pans out?
I think what's really going to surprise people is that many of the strategies being tested right now are FDA-approved drugs, so they can move into the clinic very quickly. They already have a good safety profile. And I would anticipate that there will be data showing progress, not showing cure, but showing progress, for example, reducing the size of a reservoir much sooner than people expect. I would anticipate it within the next year or two, we'll actually see progress on this front. And millions of new dollars are going to this idea that once was in the realm of charlatans and quacks. These are now all the leading research groups are doing this now.
Exciting stuff. John Cohen, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
Science contributing correspondent John Cohen writes about the emerging race to cure HIV infections in a News Focus in this week's issue. Artificial solar cells, or photovoltaics, harvest energy from sunlight and convert it into electricity that can drive a variety of processes. Plants, of course, had been harvesting solar energy for millions of years and using it to create chemical fuels and biomass through the very different process of photosynthesis. But which process is more efficient? Robert Blankenship of the Washington University in St. Louis and an international group of 17 other scientists in chemistry, biology, and physics tackle that question in a review article in this week's Science. The answers to the efficiency question turn out to be not at all obvious, but they have implications for building a sustainable energy infrastructure for society over the long haul. Here's Robert Blankenship.
This paper grew out of a workshop that I organized on behalf of the Department of Energy to get at this question of what really is the efficiency of photosynthesis and how does it compare to photovoltaic cells. Obviously, one wants to know the basic efficiencies of these processes as a way of making decisions about how to direct research funds and also how to direct new developments.
And I guess the first question you need to ask here is just how do you, you know, what do you measure as efficiency in this context? We
Right.
seem to be comparing two very different systems here.
Well, that was one of the challenges that we faced in this effort, in that even though both of these processes are solar energy storage processes, they work in rather different ways, and so it's sort of an apples to oranges type of comparison. So we worked very hard to come up with consistent definitions of efficiency, make sure that we were comparing the same regions of the solar spectrum and similar sorts of products that the two systems produced, so as to, as much as possible, come up with an apples-to-apples type comparison.
And when you say similar sorts of products, could you talk a little bit more about what that means?
Photovoltaic cells produce electricity, and photosynthetic organisms produce molecules, fuels, sugars or oils or something of that sort. And so those are rather different forms of energy. And so we had to try to, in a sense, convert one into the other. And so the way we accomplished that was we mentally took the electricity produced by the photovoltaic cell and used that in an electrolysis system to convert water into hydrogen and oxygen. And then the energy content of the hydrogen, which can be burned as a fuel, can be compared to the energy content of the fuels that a photosynthetic organism produces.
So basically, you're looking at the energy and efficiency associated with sort of a water splitting reaction.
That's right.
Okay.
And the energy that a photosynthetic organism stores in terms of the products that it produces are actually at a very similar energy level to hydrogen. So that was actually a pretty close comparison that we could make there.
Okay, so when we define, you know, the target in this way and define efficiency in this way, how does photosynthesis compare with photovoltaics in terms of generating energy?
Well, that's an interesting question. There's a lot of misconceptions out there on that. I have a slide that I show that has a cornfield next to a big photovoltaic array, and I ask audiences which is more efficient and to vote on it. And the vote is usually something like 90% in favor of photosynthesis, even in professional science audiences. But the truth is actually the opposite, that the photovoltaic system is significantly more efficient in terms of its actual conversion of solar energy into fuels.
And how much more efficient are we talking about?
Well, after you take into account various factors in terms of the electrolysis and the efficiency of the device itself and so on, a sort of an average value for photovoltaics is around 10% efficiency, and that's over the entire solar spectrum. For photosynthesis, a sort of average value, maybe across all of agriculture, would be something like 1%, and numbers up to 4.5% or 5% have been documented in certain situations. So it's at least a factor of 2 or perhaps more than that, more efficient in terms of the photovoltaics.
Well, I guess in some ways that's not a surprise. I mean, plants didn't evolve to produce energy for humans.
That's right.
Just enough food for themselves. I guess are they in some sense just not tuned for this? Or?
Well, I think that's right. And we're learning more about how plants work and how their systems are not necessarily set up for the highest efficiency. They have evolved, as you say, for reproductive success, not to produce the maximum amount of energy. So that we've identified as part of our work several places in the natural plant system that are particular sources of the inefficiency that are there, and some of those we're thinking about possible ways to improve those.
So what are some of those factors?
Well, one of the things is that a plant will only use essentially the same part of the solar spectrum that we can see with our eyes, the so-called visible part of the solar spectrum. But there's actually quite a lot of energy, especially in the longer wavelength infrared region of the spectrum, that the plant just doesn't use. The photovoltaic cell will use a significantly larger fraction of that solar spectrum. So that's one of the big areas of the inefficiency in plants, is that right off the bat, they throw away about half of the energy in the solar spectrum. So there are a couple of possible approaches to that. One is to put in slightly different pigments that expand the plant absorption range, and that's one of the projects we're working on, is to include additional types of pigments, and one that we're using is called chlorophyll D, which pushes the absorption of the plant out about another 50 nanometers into the red region and gives you up to 19% additional photon flux that you can absorb there. So it can be a significant improvement. Other more far-reaching ideas are to put in things like bacteria chlorophylls and pigments that absorb much farther into the near-infrared. That involves a more sort of global redesign of the system.
Well, you also mentioned in your paper something that you refer to as the legacy biochemistry of plants and a particular protein in photosynthesis that seems to be part of the problem.
It's likely that photosynthetic organisms evolved after the sort of major metabolic cycles in most organisms had been invented. And so the ability to use light energy was, in a sense, grafted onto that. And in some respects, there's a mismatch between the amount of energy that's present in a typical photon and the amount of energy that would be present in many biochemical systems. So there is that aspect of it. And one of the places where the natural system really falls down is in the carbon fixation enzyme RuBisCO, ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase oxygenase. This is the first enzyme that takes carbon dioxide and fixes it into an organic compound. And this is sort of a famous enzyme for being inefficient and is inhibited by oxygen and has a very sort of low turnover rate. And so there are lots of efforts to try to improve that through a variety of mechanisms to improve that particular part of the system.
Well, let's step back and look at the bigger picture. Clearly, our energy future is a big issue going forward. There's obviously been a lot of talk about the role of plants and biofuels, as something to help manage the transition to an environment less dominated by fossil fuels. You've laid out some basic information in this paper. What do you think are the policy implications of what you lay out here?
Well, I think that many people agree that no single approach is going to be adequate to meet our energy needs. And so we really need to take all possible angles and look at them, including photovoltaics and including biofuels. And what this does is it allows us to focus on some of the parts of the biofuel picture that maybe can be improved using some more modern molecular biology, so-called synthetic biology techniques, and really make some significant improvements in how those systems work rather than just accepting what nature has given us as the only possibility.
Well, Robert Blankenship, thanks very much.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Robert Blankenship is the lead author of a new Science Review article comparing the efficiencies of photosynthesis and photovoltaics. Finally today, David Grimm, the online news editor of Science, is here with a few notable stories from our daily news site. Well, first, Dave, the link between the mobility of leeches and human happiness. This one ought to be good.
Well, Stuart, this story is about how leeches can eat so much. In fact, some leeches can gorge on so much blood that they can swell up to 10 times their normal size, as disgusting as that sounds, and still wriggle away. And as you say, the trick has to do with a human hormone known as serotonin. The mystery here is, if you sort of think about a balloon, balloon. If a balloon is not fully blown up, you can sort of play with it, you can expand it, you can contract it. That's very much like the muscles in our body. The way we move around is our muscles expand and contract. But if you were to fill that balloon almost up to busting, it's not very malleable at all. And our muscles are the same way. When they're stretched to their limit, they can't expand and contract. So it's been a mystery of how leeches can become so swollen, and yet they're still able to do the expanding and contracting they need to do to wriggle around.
And so to solve this mystery, someone had to play around a lot with some swollen leeches, it sounds like.
They did. It probably wasn't the most pleasant experiment. And actually, one of the authors has said that she actually has trouble getting people to come into her lab because she's working with leeches all day. But basically, yes, she and a colleague filled a tank with sheep blood, added some leeches, sort of let them go crazy and drink as much blood as they wanted. And then they chopped the leeches up. So not a good ending for the leeches. But they chopped the leeches up and they stimulated these pieces of leeches with electrical current to figure out how their muscles expand and contract. And what they also did was they added some serotonin, which has already been shown to be important in leech feeding. It wasn't really known what its function was in how the leeches use their muscles. And then what they found was that without the serotonin, the leeches or the leech pieces had a very hard time expanding and contracting, just like a very extended muscle would. But when they added the serotonin, they had a much easier time getting the leech muscles to expand and contract. So they hypothesized that somehow serotonin relaxes the leech muscles and allows them to expand and contract, even though they are really almost stretched beyond their limits.
And it sounds from the story like they almost turned them into super muscles in a way, I mean, in terms of their contraction.
They were. And in fact, the muscles were able to stretch up to 300%. In humans, we only get a muscle change of about 20%.
So good news for the leeches. The next story, I guess, an interesting kind of gastronomic take on the history of dog domestication.
Well, right, sir. This story is about the first evidence of dogs in the New World. And while that sounds like good news, it actually has sort of an unfortunate twist because these early dogs appear to have been dinner. This story is about a human coprolite, and the coprolite is basically a fossilized feces that was found in a cave in Texas. And this coprolite's about 9,000 years old. Specifically, it's 9,260 years old, according to radiocarbon dating. And when scientists were looking in this coprolite, they detected some prickly pear seeds, which was a common component of the human diet way back then. They also found some small bones belonging to fish, birds, and rodents. But they found one bone that they found highly unusual. It belonged to a relatively large mammal. They couldn't figure out what it was, and so they did some analysis, and it turns out this bone belongs to the occipital condyle, which is a knob-like structure that's found on the back of the head of dogs. And so they said, well, this seems to be evidence that humans were not only living with dogs at this very early time, but also eating them as well. They did some more genetic analysis with this, and the genetic analysis revealed that this wasn't a wolf or something else, some other member of the dog family. The DNA suggested that this was a dog that belonged to modern and ancient dogs. But anyway, you cut it, this was a dog that would have been probably not easily mistaken for one of our companions today. They figured this dog was about 25 to 30 pounds and possessed a short nose and is similar to what scientists believe the type of dogs that Native Americans hung out with around this time. But this dog probably did not meet a happy end because if he was a companion, he also ended up on somebody's dinner plate as well.
Well, I guess, I mean, we're a bit put off by it now, but it doesn't seem that surprising to me that ancient humans might have regarded dogs as food any more than any other animals.
Exactly. And actually, there's actually very recent evidence. In 1912, the Norwegian explorer Roald Amundsen actually ate his sled dogs on a trip to the South Pole and said they were actually quite tasty, or at least it wasn't a real hardship to eat these dogs. And there's also
not a hardship for him.
Not a hardship for him, maybe for the dogs. And also there are tales of Aboriginal hunters in Greenland eating their sled dogs in the winter. And actually, there are some cultures in the world today that still eat dogs. So while this story may not sit well with a lot of Americans, this probably wasn't a very unusual practice, as you allude to, Stuart.
And finally, a bit of misbehavior by planets outside of the solar system. Tell us about that.
Well, Stuart, although the planets in our solar system are widely varied, they all have one thing in common. They all orbit our sun in the same way. But that is not the case for a lot of other solar systems out there. In 2009, scientists found what's called a hot Jupiter. And basically, this is a very large planet about the size of Jupiter, but that orbits so close to its sun that it's very hot, hence the name hot Jupiter. But what was unusual about this planet was that it was orbiting in the opposite direction to the spin of its sun.
Well, I guess that's not like our solar system.
Definitely not like our solar system. And for a few years now, scientists have been trying to figure out how that happens. And the theory was that as a solar system forms, there's a disk of gas and dust that whirls around the star in one direction. Planets form out of this disk. But sometimes the hypothesis went that these planets, when they're forming, can sort of interact with each other, sort of jostle each other around, sort of like a pretty violent game of pool. And when this happens, it's possible that some planets will start orbiting in the wrong direction. But in this new study, researchers come up with another idea. They ran some computer simulations of hot Jupiters and other planets that might be orbiting in the wrong direction, or at least what we call the wrong direction because it's different from how our solar system works, around its star. And what they found was that if there was a planet or a brown dwarf that was some distance away from the star and a planet that was orbiting it, that over time, this object could exert enough gravitational influence on the planet that would actually start tilting it and tilting it and tilting it even more and more until at some point its orbit actually flipped in the opposite direction, and then it started orbiting its star in a different direction than the star was spinning.
That seems a little bit like spooky action at a distance. I mean, it's a kind of a weak interaction for such a massive effect.
It is, but according to the computer simulations, it does work. It does take a long time for this to happen, and it's not the final word. I mean, obviously, this is just a computer simulation. As one outside expert notes, it's an interesting idea, but to really prove that this is actually happening, scientists are actually going to have to find these brown dwarfs or other objects that are actually exerting this effect on the planets to see if this is actually what is causing the planets to flip their orbits in the first place.
Well, Dave, what other stories are you looking into for the news site?
Well, Stuart, for Science Now, we've got a story on quantum computers, a new progress in actually creating these types of computers. Also a story about how seals sense fish by using their whiskers, especially in very murky water. For Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got a story about Germany shutting down a controversial stem cell clinic. There's a lot of these clinics popping up around the world that promise miraculous stem cell therapies, and Germany, for one, is starting to really crack down on these. Also a story about the devastating tornadoes that recently hit the U.S. and how scientists are utilizing pictures that were taken on the ground to figure out exactly how these tornadoes wreaked their havoc. And finally, on Science Live, our new weekly chat with scientists on the hottest topics in science, we've got a chat with prominent scientists about new avenues towards curing AIDS. This relates to the news focus that you talked about earlier in the podcast, Stuart. It'll be a great chance for readers to ask their questions about what is going on in the field of AIDS research. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. And that wraps up the May 13th, 2011 edition of the Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Stuart Wills. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.